Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the prophets of cancer right after this. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of our two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. The school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. Rule number one is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Now, if you can learn to practice rule one, you can win about 90% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. So don't give the prosecution the victory. At least make them work for it. Now listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation and indeed sometimes police intimidation. One judge put it this way. He said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" That comes from a case called U.S. versus Dickerson. Another judge put it this way. He said, "You can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment," in Belknap versus United States. And the third judge said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as protecting the innocent and the farsighted." And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. If you're online, go to our webpage, georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com. Just click on to the archives page and download it directly from our website. All right, we're talking about the politics and the prophets of cancer. The cause of cancer, as we've discussed earlier, is further identified by Dr. Otto Warburg's famous lecture. It's called The Prime Cause and Prevention of Cancer, which Warburg delivered at a 1966 annual meeting of the Nobelists at Lindau, Germany. Dr. Warburg won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1931 for his discovery of the oxygen-transferring enzyme of cell respiration, and he was voted a second Nobel Prize in 1944 for his discovery of the hydrogen-transferring enzymes. He is director of the Max Planck Institute for Cell Physiology in Berlin, Germany. He said, summarized in a few words, the prime cause of cancer is replacement of the respiration of oxygen in a normal body cell by the fermentation of sugar. All normal body cells meet their energy needs by respiration of oxygen, whereas cancer cells meet their energy needs in great part by fermentation. All normal body cells are thus obligate aerobes, whereas all cancer cells are partial anaerobes. Oxygen gas, the donor of energy in plants and animals, is dethroned in the cancer cells and replaced by an energy-yielding reaction of the lowest living forms, namely a fermentation of glucose. Dr. Warburg asks that anaerobesis of cancer cells should be accepted at once by all scientists, stating that in Lindau, it was explained that on the basis of anaerobiasis, there is now a real chance to get rid of this terrible disease. It is noteworthy that 25 years have elapsed with no response from the scientific community. Dr. Warburg concludes that nobody today can say that one does not know what cancer and its prime cause or case is. On the contrary, there is no longer an excuse that one cannot do more about prevention. How long prevention will be avoided depends on how long the prophets of agnosticism will succeed in inhibiting the application of scientific knowledge in the cancer field. In the meantime, millions of men must die of cancer unnecessarily. Now, note the date here is 1966. This is a fellow who's won two Nobel Prizes. He says the cause of cancer is sugar. See how simple that is? Now, we Americans consume 22 teaspoons of sugar per day. 22 per day. Your body can only dispose of 3 teaspoons of sugar per day. This is the added sugar, not the natural sugars that your body takes in from your food. The complex carbohydrates that you drink in milk or that you eat in your cabbage or your cauliflower or in a peach or a pear. Those are called complex carbohydrates. Now, there are simple carbohydrates like CNH, pure cane sugar from Hawaii. Now, those simple carbohydrates are what we find in soda pop. One 12-ounce can of soda pop contains 9 teaspoons of sugar. That's 3 times more than your body can dispose of in a normal 24-hour day. Now, I don't know how many cans of soda pop Americans drink today, but we're now drinking twice as much soda pop as we did 20 years ago. Twice as much. Coincidentally, the incidence of diabetes in the United States is double what it was 20 years ago. I could become a prophet. It's my prophecy that if we can double the consumption of soda pop in the United States over the next 20 years, we will also double the incidence of diabetes. Now, we're reviewing the book, Murder by Injection, Chapter 3, which is called The Prophets of Cancer. Prophets, not predicting the future, but how much money can we make off of cancer? So I showed you that there is the system of interlocking boards of directors. And all of these interlocking boards of directors lead back to one source. It's called the Rockefeller Trust. It's the Rockefeller business interests. It's banking, it's industry, it's medicine, pharmaceuticals, a who's who of who sits on these boards of directors has been put together here by Eustace Mullins. And he points out that an interesting footnote to history is the revelation of the cozy relationships which developed between the top Nazi officials and the founders of the Zionist terrorist network. Haganah and the Ergun Zvi Luini in the closing days of the Second World War. The Zionists were working to drive the British out of Palestine. The Nazis were also at war with England, which gave birth to the most curious political alliance of the 20th century. One of the leading advocates of working with the Abwehr, German intelligence, was one Yitzhak Shamir, now Premier of Israel. After the war, the Zionists employed many former Nazis to help set up their military opposition to the British. The leader in this alliance was the veteran of the old Stern Gang of terrorists, which was now the Ergun Zvi Lewimi, none other than Menachem Begin. One of Begin's proteges was a young woman named Matilda J., as she was known in terrorist circles. She was born in Switzerland after her father left Italy because of poor economic conditions. No political ideology there. The present Mrs. Krim is described by current biography as a geneticist and a philanthropist. She has been the resident biologist at the American Cancer Society for many years. In her younger days, she joined the Ergun Zvi Lewimi, marrying a fellow terrorist in a show of solidarity. She soon became a favorite of Begin and divorced her husband. It was Begin who was asked by a grinning Mike Wallace on the program 60 Minutes, quote, "Did you really introduce terrorism into the politics of the Middle East?" And Menachem Begin answered emphatically, "Not just the Middle East, but the whole world." He was referring to the worldwide terrorist operations of the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, which is directly financed by the CIA with American taxpayers' funds. Matilda J. then went on to work at the Weizmann Institute in Israel, and one day she was introduced to one of its wealthiest American directors, the movie mogul Arthur Krim. They were married, making her an American citizen. Krim has been the chief lobbyist in Washington for the major film companies for many years. He is also a principal fundraiser for the Zionist Agitprop Network, and as a fundraiser, he was also a close friend of President Lyndon B. Johnson. Krim and his wife were house guests of Johnson's at the White House when the Israelis attacked the U.S. Navy ship USS Liberty, killing many of her crew. When other American ships sent planes to aid the Liberty, immediate orders were sent from the White House for the planes to turn back. The Israelis were free to continue their attack for several more hours in a desperate attempt to sink the Liberty, to destroy the radio evidence that the Liberty had gathered that the Israelis had started the Six-Day War. Now, although it is generally believed that Krim issued the orders for the U.S. planes to turn back, no investigation was ever made. President Johnson is now dead, and they're the only living witnesses to this example of high treason from the White House. Now, the CIA had known for 24 hours that an attack was planned against the Liberty, in the hopes of bringing the United States into the war on the side of Israel. Faked evidence had already been planted that the attack would come from the Egyptians. Matilda Krim is now a director of the Rockefeller Foundation. She and her husband are directors of the Afro-American Institute. Arthur Krim has a long record of supporting left-wing causes in New York, the New York School of Social Research, the Henry Street Settlement, and the Field Foundation. Krim is chairman of United Artists, now Orion Films, and as personal attorney for Armand Hammer, whose claim to fame is that he was a friend of the blood-soaked terrorist Lenin. Krim is also a director of Hammer's two principal firms, Iowa Beef and Occidental Petroleum. Occidental Petroleum, by the way, was Armand Hammer's company. Krim also served as chairman of the Democratic Finance Committee. He is chairman of the Board of Trustees of Columbia University and director of the Lyndon B. Johnson Foundation. Critics noted in 1976 that at least 18 members of the American Cancer Society's board of directors were executive officers of banks. The American Cancer Society spent $114 million in that year, 1976, but had assets of $181 million. As of August 31, 1976, 42% of the American Cancer Society's cash and investments, some $75 million, was being held in banks with which these officers were affiliated. The 1975 budget of the American Cancer Society reported that 57 cents went for administration. The amount allocated for research was less than the salaries of its 2,900 employees. The American Cancer Society, for all practical purposes, controlled the National Cancer Institute, which is a government agency. Former National Cancer Institute Director Frank J. Rauscher became the senior vice president of the American Cancer Society, with his salary doubled to $75,000 a year. Now, an ACS spokesman admitted that 70% of its 1976 research budget went to individuals or institutions with which its board members were affiliated. Pat McGrady, who served for 25 years as science editor of the American Cancer Society, told writer Peter Chowka, "Medicine has become venal, second only to the law. The American Cancer Society's slogan, 'Control Cancer with a Checkup and a Check,' it's phony because we're not controlling cancer. That slogan is the extent of the American Cancer Society scientific, medical, and clinical savvy. Nobody in the science and medical departments there is capable of doing any real science. They are, however, wonderful professionals who know how to raise money. They don't know how to prevent cancer or to cure patients. Instead, they close the door to innovative ideas. American Cancer Society money goes to scientists who put on the best show to get grants or who have friends on the grant-giving panels." This is probably the most reliable summation of what is done with your contributions to the American Cancer Society. And as we pointed out earlier, it is the masses giving alms to the big rich who know how to distribute these funds among themselves, their friends, and their favorite tax-exempt organizations, which in many cases are refuges for the more incompetent members of their families. The American Cancer Society directors are drawn from the best people in New York, the jet set, the trendy Park Avenue crowd, who were caricatured by novelist Tom Wolfe as radical chic. At one time, black power was in. Now, it's homosexuality and cancer. This group constantly advertises itself as being obsessed with compassion and caring, which is always done with other people's money. Their own wallets remain glued to their backsides. This is exemplified by the bleeding hearts on the national news shows, who nightly regale us with their version of the homeless, the starving in Africa, or wherever they can find a photogenic victim with flies crawling on him. These journalists, who are paid millions of dollars a year, have never been known to toss their coins to these victims. In politics, its morals are exemplified by the fat, aging playboy, Senator Ted Kennedy. In Hollywood, by the equally pudgy Elizabeth Taylor. Matilda Krim is now the guiding genius behind the newly created American Foundation for AIDS Research, because of her powerful Hollywood connections. She was easily able to persuade Elizabeth Taylor and other stars to raise millions for her pet project. She also recruited her old friend Mary Lasker as the first board member of AIDS. Mary Lasker paid the current advertising genius, Jerry Della Famina, to create a tasteful national ad campaign for the distribution and use of condoms. The Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center continues to be the most fashionable charity among the New York societies and socialites, and certainly it is the most influential. It is listed on the Trends Upper East Side as the Society of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and it has operated a popular thrift shop on 3rd Avenue for many years, which is filled with donations from wealthy families. Like many other young writers and artists, the present writer purchased his clothes there for years, all of it labeled from the most expensive shops in New York. Because the fight against cancer is totally controlled by the Rockefeller medical monopoly, grants are routinely awarded, which are nothing more than payoffs. One WAG claims that the American Cancer Society will award a research grant only if the recipient signs a paper swearing that he will not find a cure for cancer. Although only the tip of the iceberg has been revealed, there have been numerous exposés attesting that most of the cancer research is bogus, replete with faked results. In one of the more publicized incidents, the National Cancer Institute gave $980,000 to a researcher at Boston University who was forced to resign after charges that he had falsified his research data. Another well-known incident at the August Memorial Center itself found that mice were painted different colors in order to verify certain cancer tests. Dr. William Summerlin of Sloan Kettering admitted painting the mice to make them look as though successful skin grafts had been done. The National Bureau of Standards reports that half or more of the numerical data published by scientists in articles in the journal is unusable because there is no evidence that the researchers accurately measured what they thought they were measuring. Alarmed by these statistics, officials instituted a survey. 31 authors of scientific reports were sent questionnaires asking for their raw data. The 21 who replied said that their data had been lost or accidentally destroyed. What a loss to the research profession. 21 out of 31 lost it. Now, the reliability of the nation's researchers wilted under a blistering exposé on 60 Minutes on January 17, 1988, under the title, "The Facts Were Fiction." The subject of the exposé was one of the leading scientific scholars in the nation. He had claimed to have done extensive research on the mentally retarded at a state institution where the records clearly showed that he had only worked on goldfish. The 60 Minutes report estimated that from 10 to 30% of all research projects carried out in the United States are totally faked. Because of the requirements to win the grantsman race, startling results must be claimed before serious consideration is given to requests for funding, which themselves are hardly small amounts. They often amount to grants of millions of dollars. One academic scholar who was interviewed on 60 Minutes declared that I would think twice before I believe what I read in the medical journals. Now, it is dishonest, fraudulent information. The moving spirit behind all of this fakery is the unwillingness of the big rich to see their profits imperiled by any genuine advances in medicine. Therefore, the more fake research that is done, the less chance that a drug now on the market, which is bringing in $100 million a year in profits or more, will be knocked off the market. The wholesale fakery in American research is almost entirely due to the pressures of the Rockefeller medical monopoly and the drug firms that are firmly under their control. who routinely present elaborately faked tests to the Food and Drug Administration to obtain approval for their new products, concealing the harmful side effects, which often include liver and kidney damage or death. The control of the universities by the medical monopoly creates a breeding ground for more robotic minions willing to abase themselves in any manner for a grant or a job which requires little or no performance. A lengthy history of faked research is an ideal to control or keep these minions in line. It is frightening to contemplate that such faked research is usually the basis for the acceptance or the denial of new drugs while protecting the establishment as it continues to reap more profits from long outmoded and discredited panaceas and procedures. And yet this is the background, as well as the reason for President Reagan's brave new budget for 1989, which sets aside $64 billion for research and development. Although this is only a 4% increase over 1988, it represents a 52% increase since Reagan took office. The National Institute of Health budget has doubled to $6.2 billion. Cancer research will receive $1.5 billion, while AIDS is earmarked for an expenditure of $2 billion. Matilda Krim must be very happy. Now, critics have pointed out that Memorial Sloan Kettering had done practically no research on the prevention of cancer, only on its favored modes of treatment. The basic premise of its researchers, that the cell is solely responsible for the multiplication of cancer cells, is probably erroneous. However, it is the basis for all of their work, including their promotion of chemotherapy. In fact, the cell is probably reacting to outside infection or pressures, and the fault is not in the cell. The Sloan-Kettering approach dangles the promise of a magic bullet, which will bring the cell back to a healthy regimen through medication or chemotherapy. The chemotherapy drugs include alkylating agents, which actually inhibit cell growth. They're alkaloids, which hinder cell mitosis or cell division. Sloan-Kettering also bypasses the possibility of stimulating the immune system to respond to cancer growth, which is the normal method which the body uses to fight all disease. This institution receives $70 million a year from various tax-exempt foundations, including the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which means that the American taxpayer is subsidizing all of this research. 130 full-time scientists are doing research at the center. All 345 physicians at the center are also heavily involved in research. And what are the results of all of this activity? It is a continued reliance on the now antiquated cut, slash, and burn techniques, still redolent of the mad doctor practices of the late doctors J. Marvin Sims and James Ewing, although dead these many years. While wedded to the ritual observance of these expensive, painful, and futile procedures, the scientists at Sloan-Kettering maintain a resolute phalanx of opinion, denouncing various holistic procedures which rely on diet, nutrition, and vitamins. Now, Dr. Muriel Shimkin of the National Institute of Health wrote in the Institute's official primer on cancer in 1973 that treatment of cancer by diet alone is in the realm of quackery. Yet, the American Cancer Society, faced with a growing amount of evidence to the contrary, issued a special report in 1984 advising the following program. First, avoid obesity. Second, cut down total fat intake to 30% of total calories. Three, eat more high-fiber foods. Four, eat foods rich in vitamins A and C. Five, include vegetables in the diet. Six, be moderate in the consumption of alcohol. And seven, moderate consumption of salt-cured, smoked, and nitrate-cured foods. Now, this is a very sensible regimen. However, it has not been emphasized by the American Cancer Society or the National Institute of Health, nor do many doctors include this advice in their recommendations to their patients. The American Cancer Society has always had one bugaboo, and that is Laetril. Dr. Lewis Thomas, longtime head of Sloan Kettering, told the American Cancer Society Science Writers Seminar on April 2, 1975, that Laetril had absolutely no value in combating cancer. Now, this contradicted the work done by the center's own scientists, whose real results had been suppressed. And Dr. Thomas stated again in 1975 that Laetril has been shown after 2 years of tests to be worthless in fighting cancer. Well, Dr. Robert Good, president of Sloan Kettering, had also stated in January of 1974, at this moment there is no evidence that Laetril has an effect on cancer. His own scientists had completed studies which showed the opposite. Two researchers, Dr. Lloyd Schoen and Dr. Elizabeth Sorokat, both working independently at the Sloan Kettering Center, had found that pineapple enzymes combined with Laetril resulted in total tumor regression in 50% of their experiments on 34 experimental animals there. And one of the most famous beneficiaries of the Laetril treatment was the actor Steve McQueen. He had been given up by his physicians as a terminal case when he tried Laetril. He was responding well until a physician persuaded him to undergo surgery on a tumor. He then died on the operating table of the embolism. The establishment proclaimed that this proved the Laetril treatment was worthless. Harold Manner of the Cancer Center also found a combination of Laetril, enzymes, and vitamin A had a similar positive effect on mice with cancer. Dr. Kinematsu Sugara, who had been at Memorial Sloan Kettering since 1917, after earlier working on cancer at the Harriman Institute, had also produced striking results proving that Laetril was effective on cancer in experimental animals. On June 13, 1973, the results of cancer tests using Laetril by Dr. Suguria over a period of 9 months stated, quote, "The results clearly show that amygladin scientifically inhibits the appearance of lung metastasis in mice." Although this had been announced by the Sloan Kettering Institute on January 10, 1974, Dr. Robert Good, president of Sloan Kettering, denounced the news of the findings as a premature leak. Dr. Ralph Moss, who was then public relations director at the Cancer Center, considered Sagara's work a genuine breakthrough and a welcome departure from Sloan Kettering's singular lack of success in its cancer work. Well, on November 17, 1977, he held a press conference at the Hilton Hotel in New York. Instead of receiving praise for publicizing the success at the center, he was fired the next day. He later wrote an excellent book. It was entitled The Cancer Syndrome, which exposes many of the strange events at Sloan Kettering. His book is very factual, and it is written without rancor against those who had thrown him out. Let me pause right there and give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and it's heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. And it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com, and download that free General Law CD package yourself. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate by endorsing and recommending the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book called Murder by Injection, the story of the medical conspiracy against America. Chapter 3 deals with cancer. It's about 70 pages of material with the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence taken from other sources, both governmental and official sources of the various institutions that are being reviewed here in this Chapter 3. The author is Eustace Mullins, E-U-S-T-A-C-E Mullins. Book was first written in 1988, reprinted in 1992. And if you're looking for a copy of it, I'm going to send you to a place where I know you can get it, and that's called BraveNewBookstore.com. BraveNewBookstore.com is located in Austin, Texas, and their phone number is 512-480-2503. Again, that's 512-480-2503. Now, this book has been discriminated against. It has been set out for an attack by the Libraries of America. If you go into your public library and you want to check this book out, you won't find it there. An example of that in the Tulsa City County Library System in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They were sent a copy back in 1988, and they wrote a letter to the person who donated the book for the library on October 18th, 1988. Said, "Thank you for loaning us your copy of Murder by Injection, the story of the medical conspiracy against America by Eustace Mullins. I asked a committee of staff members to review the book as a consideration for addition to a library collection. The reviewers found that the book is primarily an attack on the medical community, the Rockefeller Foundation, the American Cancer Society, the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the fluoridation of water, and the vaccination against polio. Based upon the reviews by the committee and the library's criteria for material selection, this book will not be added to the library collection," signed by the director. So, with that in mind, you're probably not going to find it at your local public library. That being the case, you'll probably have to buy a copy, and I don't know what the copies cost. I've had this one for many years, and I would imagine $20-$30 probably. $19.95 maybe. $29.95 maybe at Barnes & Noble. That's assuming that Barnes & Noble has it or can get it for you. Now, most of the books that I've asked for at Barnes & Noble, they've been able to get for me, so just give it a test and give it a try. If you're looking for a used copy of it, you might find one in a used bookstore. And the way you do that is you go to your used bookstore and you give them the name of the book and the author. And most of these used bookstores worldwide are hooked up on the internet. And I have found books that I've been looking for in places like Cape Town, South Africa, or Long Beach, California. And it's a hell of a system. Used books like this one, there's going to be a lot of them out there. You can probably get for $5 or $10 or something like that. Or in some cases where you've got a book that's hard to find, I mean, it might have been published, say, back in the 1930s or 20s or 1890s, and you're looking for a copy of a book, sometimes it's worth paying $50 or $75 for. That's how rare they are. I oftentimes do that. Go to your used bookstore, give them the name of the book, Murder by Injection, the story of the medical conspiracy against America, and the author's name, Eustace Mullins, E-U-S-T-A-C-E. They'll plug that into the computer and they'll find you a copy in Cape Town, South Africa, or Long Beach, California. Going on, he says, because Elmer Bobst had played the crucial role in making it possible for Richard Nixon to become president, he had little trouble in persuading Nixon to authorize a new and expensive war on cancer. You remember that? Some of you old guys out there, you old ladies, huh? The war on cancer. President Nixon did that. At Bobst's instigation, Nixon signed the National Cancer Act in 1971, which transformed the National Cancer Institute at Bethesda, Maryland, into a new, monolithic government bureaucracy. During the next 15 years, the National Cancer Institute was to spend more than $10 billion funding various cancer programs, none of which had any effect in curing or preventing cancer. Let me pause right here, put my mark here in the margin. Now take a look at the amount of money that's been spent. Cancer research in 1988 in the United States was receiving $1.5 billion a year. It started off with a $2 billion program in 1971. Now, I don't know how many billions of dollars have been expended on cancer in total, but to come to a conclusion that it's $100 billion or more, I think would be conservative. $100 billion. Now, I have reported on this program on numerous occasions that there are 14 cures to cancer. When your doctor tells you that you have cancer, You have 14 courses of action to take. Now keep in mind that I'm just a crummy plumber by trade. Now if a crummy plumber knows of 14 cures to cancer, of which I have used personally one of those, the Indian black salve. My wife has had cancer since 1978. And she's been treating it with nutrition and a couple of other therapies that she's used now for 30 years. So I live with cancer here in my home, been here for 25 years. We don't claim that we're cancer specialists or that we're super gurus concerning cancer. Just Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. And if I know that, and I'm spending the time, effort, and energy here to inform you, the next time somebody tells you you've got cancer, why don't you take a few minutes and look into the cancer issue? And then educate yourself to these 14 cures to cancer. And I'm not telling you that you shouldn't be cut on. You know, if you want to go have it cut out, you know, that's a choice for you to make. And it works. 37% of the time, cut, burn, and poison works. 63% of the time, it doesn't work. But you need to be thinking about, do I want to go the cut, burn, and poison route first time out? Because chemotherapy and surgery are oftentimes irreversible. And if you're in that 63% group and you go the cut, burn, and poison route, after you have impaired your immune system, after you have cut off your breasts and cut out your lymph system, ladies, the lymph part of your immune system has now been destroyed, and it's your immune system that's going to cure you of the cancer. Now, they can keep you alive for 18 months for $100,000. That's pretty routine. They can keep you alive for 5 years, 37% of the time. But that doesn't mean that the cancer isn't going to come back and that you're not ultimately going to die from it. But what you're looking for here is, how long can you live with cancer? And then the answer is, in my wife's case, 30 years. How much longer can she live with it? I don't know. And we're in hopes 30 more. All right, going on here then, in 1955, the National Cancer Institute had established a chemotherapy national service center with a $25 million grant to promote the use of chemotherapy. A full-page advertisement in the New York Times on December 9, 1969 proclaimed that the cancer cure is near at hand. I'm going to underline that. Every night, Katie Couric has a report on cancer. Just test me. Just watch the CBS Evening News tonight, and Katie Couric will have a report on cancer. Cancer research, a new cancer breakthrough, a new piece of knowledge about cancer has just been discovered. Cancer is probably the most heavily advertised product in America. It is everywhere. Everywhere. Now, if it's not the most heavily advertised product, and primarily on the news programs, then it's a close second or third, right behind Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola or something on that order. I mean, it's just everywhere. Now, the story promised that a cancer cure by 1976 was a distinct possibility. Let me underline that. Distinct possibility. Cancer cure is near at hand. The chairman of the President's National Cancer Panel submitted a report admitting that the first 5 years of the National Cancer Program was a failure. The cancer toll has risen during each year of its operation. By 1985, the annual toll was 485,000 victims. Well, it's over half a million a year now. Now, about 2.6 million people die in the United States every year. 500,000 of those people are cancer victims. Now, to show you what a failure all of this cancer research has been, in 1900, your chances of getting cancer in your lifetime was 1 in 33. Today, it's 1 in 2. That's 50%. Just take a look around the room, wherever you're sitting right now. Take a look. How many people are sitting right around the room with you? Half of those people are going to get cancer in their lifetime. And in the next 11 years, they tell us it'll be 100%, 1 out of 1. Now, if you want to put your faith in the American Cancer Society or the government program to find a cure to cancer, you know, be my guest. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But let me reiterate, there are already 14 cures to cancer. Latril is one of them. Latril was experimented on and by the Sloan Kettering Foundation. And when they found how valuable it was, they took the guy that discovered it and they fired him. I just reported that to you. Now, if you'd like to have a copy of that kind of information, it's in this book called Murder by Injection by Eustace Mullins. Better than that, there's a bibliography in here. It gives you all of his sources of information so that you can do further research, so you can find out whether or not Mullins is lying to you. I mean, the guy that made the discovery, he wrote a book. Now, once in a while, we get the information from the insider. Some guy that's in the operation comes out and he says, okay, let me tell you what's going on here. Now, the average Joe Sixpack is not going to do that. He's out busy running and marching for cancer. You know, he's a good minion and he does his job well. God love him. And I'm not debasing any of you people out there that want to run for cancer, want to march on cancer. You know, your heart's in the right place. But let's understand that the money that you're giving to the super rich. You're not giving it to Joe Sixpack over here who's dying from cancer. That's number one. And then number two, the money is going to go to some quack who's doing research and is going to dummy up his results. He is never going to come up with a cure to cancer, even if he had the credentials and the ability to do so. And I've said this many times. I said, look, you've got 14 cures to cancer now. What in the hell are you going to do with the 15th, 16th, or 17th cure? What do you need it for? Why do you need to spend billions of dollars a year to come up with a new cure to cancer when you've already got 14? The hell are you going to do with it? It's like a guy that has 14 cars. Then he says, oh my God, I got to go out and buy this new car. What are you going to do with it? You can't drive the 14 that you got. So you got 15, 16, 17, 18 cars. What are you going to do with them? I could see having two cars or three, but you know, what the hell are you going to do with 14, 15, or 16? Now, more than 43,000 people deluged Nixon with demands that the NCI test Laetrile. Benno Schmidt then chose a panel of scientists to make the tests. All of them were known to be fanatically opposed to Laetrile. When he asked for the scientific results, he said, I couldn't get anybody to show me his work. Had their tests shown Laetrile to be worthless, they would have been only too happy to publish their findings. The battle against Laetrile continued on a nationwide campaign. One lobbyist, Charles Offso, had a full-time job in Sacramento, California, lobbying against Laetrile. He was paid $25,000 a year to lobby against Laetrile. Drugstore proprietors who displayed books favorable to Laetrile were informed that no member of the AMA would henceforth send them prescriptions until these books were removed. Since 1963, the Federal Trade Commission has brought pressure against publishers of pro-Laetrile books. Government statutes not only prohibit the interstate shipment of Laetrile, but even of the books which recommend it. Now, Laetrile, then. Do you know what Laetrile is? I take it every day. I have to buy the apricot kernels. If you take an apricot or a peach, it's got a hard pit in the center of it. take a hammer and you break that hard pit, and inside there's a little kernel. Well, that little kernel in there is what contains this vitamin B17. Laetrile is what it's called. And I have to buy that on the black market. You can't get that anywhere. Well, I say you can't get it anywhere. I get it, and I know how to get it. But it's like going down and buying cocaine or heroin. And what is it? It's an apricot kernel. You know, it looks like an almond, little tiny almond. They're not as big as almonds, but they look the same. Same color, same shape. And the government now has banned it. And they might as well ban peaches and apricots. Now, what's the purpose behind that? First of all, it's totally harmless. I mean, you can sit there and eat that crap until hell freezes over. And you can't eat very much of it because they're really bitter. I mean, you chew a couple of those and that'll pucker you right up. So what I have to do is I got a little grinding mill here, and I grind up 20 of those little kernels every day. And I stick them into two bananas and a pound of frozen strawberries. Then I fill up my Vitamixer with milk, and then I chew that all up, and I make a couple of drinks for my wife and myself. So we take a little Laetrile every day. It's called vitamin B17. And the government is absolutely loath to have you take this vitamin B17. I'm not here to recommend it. I don't care whether you do or don't. It's not relevant to me. But the thing that's relevant here is that the government has a campaign. They have relegated Laetrile, vitamin B17, a naturally occurring vitamin, for crying out loud, to the same status as cocaine, heroin, and marijuana. Now, that ought to tell you right there that there's evil doing in River City, shouldn't it? After chiropractic, Laetrile was the most important target of the criminal syndicate operation of the Coordinating Conference of Health Information. The conspiracy launched by the American Cancer Society, the American Medical Association, and the Food and Drug Administration. It continued to be mostly a war of censorship and intimidation, whose goal was to prevent any public discussion of Laetrile. TV shows which scheduled forums on Laetrile to discuss both sides of the controversy were canceled. Tests showing the effectiveness of Laetrile were suppressed. They never reached the public. The desperation of the campaign against Laetrile was solely financial. It represented the greatest threat to the profits of the Rockefeller medical monopoly. Hospital treatment for cancer cost many thousands of dollars. Despite the cancer center's $70 million a year for research, its Memorial Hospital charged $470 a day for a bed, and a 10-day stay is about $5,000, with another $4,000 charged for treatment and the physician care. How do you like that? All right, now the reason is very simple. I mean, you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure this out. Cancer is a $500 billion a year industry, and anybody that comes up with something as simple as a vitamin to prevent cancer and wreck a $500 billion a year industry, we are going to do everything in our power to abolish, to eradicate from the minds of America and indeed the world, this concept of Laetrile. Hey, I'm out of time. I got to give you a final reminder here that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.